Daniel Klein has been a great friend of ours for years. He is a guy who has a warm, humorous, and thoughtful way to show how philosophy resonates in everyday life. Readers of his popular books, Plato and Platypus, Walk into a Bar, and Travels with Epicurus, well, they come for enlightenment, and they stay for a really fun, enjoyable story. As a young college student studying philosophy, Daniel Klein filled a notebook with short quotes from the world's great thinkers, hoping to find some guidance on how to live the best life he could now from the vantage point of his eighth decade. He revisits the wisdom he relished in his youth with this collection of philosophical gems, adding new ones that strike a chord with him at what he says is the end of his life. I guess you...
The last chapter.
The last chapter. Sounds so final, though, doesn't it? Well, all right. But I guess we'll talk about that. His new book is Every Time I Find the Meaning of Life, They Change It, Wisdom of the Great Philosophers on How to Live. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Daniel Klein back to the show. I always get a big smile on my face when I see you. I always enjoy talking to you.
And I like being here.
Yeah, it's really fun. So how did this all... well, first of all, I love the book. I love all your work, but this is very sweet.
Well, thank you. Thanks.
What is it? Talk about the idea when you were a kid of putting some of these thoughts down and then revisiting those.
Yeah, well, to tell you the truth, when I went off to college, I didn't even know what the word philosophy meant or who philosophers were. And it was only in college when friends of mine told me about these great philosophy courses they were taking that I thought, maybe that's something for me.
So you're in Harvard.
Yes.
And you say, and your major originally was what? Or I don't know?
Well, I flipped around. You know, I think my parents thought I should be a lawyer because I didn't have the makings of a doctor. So that was the alternative. You know, I hated blood, so I became a... At first I was a government major, but that was not for me. I quickly decided. As a matter of fact, I just didn't know what I wanted to do with myself in general. And I thought maybe I could get some clues from reading philosophers. And I did get some clues, but mostly philosophy was involved in things that were very hard and very academic, you know, like, you know, I mean, I wanted to know the meaning of life, but then the teachers would say, but what's the meaning of meaning?
Oh.
And then we'd have to go down that rabbit hole for a while. But in the meantime, I did start keeping this notebook of kind of what I called them pithies at the time. These little pithy remarks that philosophers would say or write that would seem like they would give me some kind of guidance of what to do. I had no idea what I wanted to do professionally with my life. I was pretty much a cipher.
And it is safe to say, I mean, not to jump to the... go right to the chase here, but it is you ended up writing, but it always sort of had somewhat of a that tone, right? That philosophical tone, a thoughtful tone, let's say.
Well, I hope so, and I guess so. I mean, I think I really was cut out for philosophy. It's I just find myself wondering about things, and I think I, even as a little kid, before I even knew what philosophy was, that people actually spent their lives wondering about things, I was cut out for it. I wasn't cut out for doing the deep stuff. That I realized as a college student. The deep stuff was too hard for me and kind of missed the point of what I was going after, which was hints on how to live.
So what is the deep stuff? The deep stuff seems to me to come up with your, instead of interpreting what is out there, to kind of come up with your own.
Well, the deep stuff is two fields particularly in philosophy. Epistemology, which is what does it mean to say something is true? What is the nature of knowledge? And the other one is logic, and that is, you know, just normal logic is fairly easy, but it gets pretty complicated when you get into something called extensional logic. But those fields, fascinating as they are, and I respect the people who do them, they don't really lead me to the big questions I have, like what is the good life and what should I do with my life and what's it all about Alfie and those and those questions.
So how does, and this is a perhaps a long question, but in those things that you wrote down in the notebook and that you've looked at and you've thought about, how does that age, as you age as a human being and you think of those things, do they have much more resonance when you're in your 20s and 30s than they do when you're in your 70s and 80s?
Well, that's a very good question, because the nature of the book was I just came across this notebook fairly recently, a few years ago. I had put it away. I had stopped collecting these pithy remarks by philosophers somewhere in my 30s. When I realized, you know, my life is happening and this stuff isn't doing me any good. So get on with it. But then I picked it up again, and looking back at the things that had really meant a lot to me, I had a different perspective on it. I guess it's normal as you get older to have a different perspective altogether on what interested you and preoccupied you when you were a young man. Like, for example, I have a really very, you know, sad quote from Jean-Paul Sartre. I was very attracted to the existentialists. And in one of his novels, Nausea, he talks about how boring life is, how it's just this endless nothingness that has no meaning, and it makes him sick with nausea. And that really resonated with me. I guess, you know, in modern psychological terms, you could say I was depressed. But in existential terms, I was having a crisis of meaning. I couldn't find out what the meaning of life was. You know, some people had found it in religion. Some people had found it in the mores of their society. But I couldn't find it. However, looking back at it, you know, in my 70s, you know, my mid-70s, I realized that part of the appeal of it was a little bit romantic. Mm. I was living in Paris at the time, trying to go to graduate school at the Sorbonne. I was reading Sartre. I had a Gauloise dangling from my lips. I sat in the parks having dark thoughts. But part of that, I realize looking back now, is I kind of saw myself as Jean-Paul Belmondo, being very romantic and French and thinking, je m'en fous, I don't care about anything. And I think that made me sort of attractive to myself. So not to discount that feeling of emptiness I had, but seeing it from this, you know, the vantage point of my old age, I have to smile a bit too.
The name of the book is Every Time I Find the Meaning of Life, They Change It. It's by Daniel Klein, Wisdom of the Great Philosophers and How to Live. When you graduated with your degree in philosophy from Harvard, how did you end up writing for television?
Well, you know, if I'm honest, altogether the business of writing I kind of backed into. I knew one thing I didn't want to do was work for a boss. Mm. I remember vividly my father coming home from work and talking about how his boss had humiliated him again. I even remember his boss's name, Ralph Lulick. This was 60 years ago. But Ralph? No, I think he's gone. But and I thought, geez, I really don't want to work for somebody else and feel the way my dad does. And this eliminated an awful lot of jobs that were available to me. And then I did have a knack for writing funny stuff. So I, you know, I kind of asked around. I was in New York, and somebody said, somebody's starting, Merv Griffin, do you remember Merv
Sure.
Griffin? Is starting a comedy quiz show called Let's Play Post Office. And so I applied for the job, and I got it, and I had the time of my life, because sitting around the table with me were four guys from Mad Magazine.
Any that we would know?
Paul Lakin, I don't know. We're talking the 1960s.
Yeah.
But they were, many of them had not even finished high school. They had just gone with their comic talent and gone on to writing greeting cards and then getting this job and doing Mad Magazine. Well, I learned more about comedy and about a kind of life that you don't learn about at Harvard from these guys.
And you were writing, so what were you writing? Because Merv, he was the creator of the show. He had done Jeopardy, and then he created this show.
Yes,
right?
He did.
So he wasn't the host.
No, I've forgotten the name of the host.
Don Morrow.
Wow! Unbelievable!
Don Morrow was the host. Do you remember who the announcer was?
No, I don't.
Bill Wendell, who was the announcer for David Letterman when he first, Late Night with David Letterman on NBC.
I used to love it. And sometimes they'd let us come to the tapings of the shows, and we'd sit there together and just laugh.
And what would you write? You would write the letters, you would write the...
Yeah.
Kind of the gags.
Yes. What they were was they were made up letters from famous people, and the contestants would try to guess who the author was.
Yeah.
And so we used puns and double meanings, and it was outrageous. And it turned out the show got very high ratings, but then the Nielsen people discovered that the only people watching it were college students. They don't buy soap suds, it turns out. So it was canceled after one season.
Yeah, and then what after that?
I did Candid Camera.
Yeah.
I made up stunts for Alan Funt. That was interesting. And then I started writing stand-up material. Probably the best stuff I did was for Flip Wilson. Do you remember Flip?
I do remember.
Yeah, he passed away regrettably very young. And he was the perfect boss, very generous. I just loved him. He was great.
So when you do that in writing for somebody in stand-up, and compare that to a more collaborative atmosphere of working at Canada Camera or working working in the game show, where I assume it's the writers around the table and sort of throwing ideas out.
Exactly. Yeah.
Where it's a little bit different when you're writing, especially in somebody's voice, and somebody is as distinctive as Flip Wilson, who I assume you work for the show or for a stand-up?
I worked for a special called Poppin' Dippity.
Poppin' Dippity.
Yes. He was the host of a bunch of singers. Well, you know what? I'll tell you the truth. This was so collaborative, even more collaborative than sitting around a table. Because what I did is I would follow Flip around all day with a notebook and write down what he said, because the man was funny from when he got up in the morning. Mm. He was just a naturally funny guy. Having coffee, he was funny. So I would write down what he say. Then I would go back to my hotel room I had a portable Olivetti typewriter, and I would kind of shape it. And then I'd give it back to him at dinner. And he'd say, "Boy, Danny, this is great stuff. Where do you come up with this stuff?" I say, "Flip, it's what you said this morning, just with the grammar corrected." So I don't even know whether you call that collaborative. I was just his editor.
Flip Wilson was, of course, known for his Geraldine character. So
yes.
Did you write for that? Or
I did. I did write some of that. I don't remember any of the lines. But
nor should you. I mean, why? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you started writing your own stuff.
Yes. What happened is when I met my wife, Freka, I was still writing, do you remember Movies of the Week?
Yes.
Every network had a Movie of the Week. And what they did was stockpile scripts. They would, they would get many more than they made. But I could always get an assignment, and then they wouldn't make them. But the assignment would pay well enough for me to live for a year. And I'd do it in about 3 weeks, and then I'd lie around on the sofa doing not much. My wife, who's a Calvinist, didn't approve. And I was about to sell another idea I had gotten for a Movie of the Week. And Freka said, "Why don't you do it as a novel instead of as a Movie of the Week that they're not going to make?"
Right.
And I said, I don't want to. I'm afraid. Oh, boy, boy. And I wrote it as a novel, and it was actually a big hit. It came out from Doubleday called Embryo. I mean, it wasn't a bestseller, but it did well. And then I started my career writing books. And that was about 35 years ago.
When you tapped into this of bringing your background of philosophy into books like Travels with Epicurus and Plato and Platypus Walk into a Bar, there is you really were tapping into something that people. It resonated with people, even with people who wouldn't think of themselves of ever picking up a book on philosophy.
Yeah, and it was surprising and very gratifying. It started with a book I wrote with my best friend from college, Tom Cathcart, who's still my best friend. And he and I had this sudden inspiration that you could explain philosophical ideas through jokes. And we wrote this book. We wrote it on speculation, the whole book. 40 publishers turned it down, saying, this is all very clever, but nobody's interested in philosophy. The 41st took it, the Abrams Company. They put it out, and it was number 3 in the New York Times bestseller list 2 weeks later. And so they were wrong, the other 40.
Yeah.
And then we wrote a few others. But we made it in kind of a series, explaining logic and then explaining philosophies of death with jokes. Turns out that we make the most jokes about the things that we're most anxious about, sex and death. And then Tom and I did some stuff on our own. Tom wrote one about the trolley problem.
Yes.
Which is fascinating. Tom is smarter than I am at philosophy, and so he could tackle the really technical stuff. And I wrote one about getting old called Travels with Epicurus, which much to my surprise, because it wasn't quite as funny as Plato and a Platypus or that series, sold very well. It was a bestseller in England for quite a while.
And this is on aging, too, ultimately.
It is. It's about the perspective of being an old guy. And kind of what brought me back to the notebook and then adding to it and adding commentary to it was the idea of one of the things that I think a lot of us do when we get old is we kind of look back over our life and we see kind of patterns in it, you know, what its narrative is, but also to see how it measured up to what we think a good life is. Mine didn't measure up too well.
Really? Why do you feel that?
I'm just kidding. I don't know. I was always a little more cautious. Like in this notebook, when I talk about the hedonists, like Epicurus and some of the others, some of the more modern ones, the ones who say the purpose of life is to get as much pleasure as you possibly can out of life. There is no other purpose in life. I kind of believed that, and I think I still kind of believe it. But I was always such a cautious little boy, you know? Like, I never went to an orgy, you know?
Well, the day's young, Daniel. I mean, you know, look.
I think I was invited
it's
once.
It's only 11:50. Well, that's good. That's, got one up on me on that, sure. So when you say every day or every time that I find the meaning of life, I mean, do you feel, not to read too much in the title, but do you feel you have come to the point, did you ever, if just describing yourself as the way you just did, it doesn't sound like you've ever had that eureka moment and go, oh, okay, I know what it is now.
No, I have not.
Yeah.
But I have had sort of a partial one, and that is the existentialists really still speak to me and always have. And the idea that you really have to take responsibility for your own life. You can't just treat yourself as an object and say, oh, I smoke because that's the way I am. I have an addictive personality.
Yeah.
You have to take responsibility for who you are and what you do. A lot of stuff is out of our control. I mean, there's a lot of randomness out there. But in terms of who you are, you know, the big questions, what you're willing to die for, what you think is of ultimate value, what you think is worthy passing on to younger people as what you think is a good way to live. Those things, you have to choose yourself. For somebody like me, they aren't written somewhere, like in the Bible or the Koran, and they aren't written by Oprah either, much as I admire her. It doesn't resonate with me. I have to make my own decisions about that. And the philosophical way of thinking helps me think that way, I think.
The philosophical way of thinking about that, when it comes to choice, of choosing what you do. So choosing how you're going to live, what you're going to do in your life, what you're going to eat, what you're not going to eat, what you're going to, you know, what you're going to drink, what you're not going to drink, all of that stuff. So is it, you can make yourself nuts thinking about that too much, can't you? I mean, at some point you just have to live.
Yes. You know, as John Lennon famously said, life is what happens while you're making other plans. Yeah, no, you just have to live, and you do. I mean, you get up in the morning, and, you know, the garbage has to be taken out, and the dog has to be fed. And,
yeah.
But I probably have spent a lot of time wondering even about the little things. And a lot of it turns out to be high comedy. I mean, there's a fantastic existential novel that was written in the mid-late 20th century called End of the Road. Do you remember that one?
I remember it.
Yeah, Barth wrote it.
Okay.
And then there was another one called The Movie Goer.
Yeah.
Can't remember his name now. And both of them talk about these tiny decisions that we have to make and that we sometimes give them the weight as if they were going to change the world, but they don't, and it becomes high comedy.
Yeah. Walter Percy, author of...
Oh, you are good.
yeah,
he was a great writer, Walker Percy.
Yeah.
He was also a bit of a theologian. He was a Catholic thinker, and he was an interesting guy. And a doctor, I believe.
How much of this do you think comes to... Because you mentioned, you don't find it in the Bible. You don't find it in the Quran. You're not finding it. But many of us do find it in
yes,
our
you
religious
do.
Teachings.
And I envy you. I envy all people who do find it, and because with it you find a whole system of conduct, what's good and what's bad. You know, that's important to know if you want to lead a good life.
Right.
How much you should put your own self below other things, how high then you should rate pleasure. It's a good deal having a belief system that you can fully embrace. It's eluded me. I don't know why, but it's my fate. Oh no, I just turned myself into an object.
but the book comes out quite optimistic.
Yeah, you know what? I've had a happy life. You know, when I look back at it, I've had my ups and downs. I've had depressions. I've had some bad relationships. But all in all, I guess I'm one happy guy.
Well, the book certainly is great. It's so much fun to read, and it's really interesting. And
Thank you.
And an awful lot of just a lot there. So it's one of those things that you can look back at and keep referring to. Every time I find the meaning of life, they change it. Wisdom of the Great Philosophers on How to Live. The book is published by Penguin. Daniel Klein, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I can't thank you enough for coming in and talking to us this morning.
Thank you so much,
always
Joe.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.